The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Tonight, we are honored to have with us award-winning Chilean author Antonio Skarmeta in conversation with Veronica Cortinez. A native of Chile and the grandson of Yugoslav immigrants, Antonio Skarmeta studied philosophy and literature at the University of Chile. Receiving his master's degree from Columbia University in 1967 and publishing his first novel the following year. He went on to work as a literary and artistic director and to teach literature from 1967 to 1973 at the University of Chile, a period in which he wrote several novels. Following the Pinochet coup of 1974, he fled Chile, first to Buenos Aires and then to West Berlin. In 1989, after the collapse of Pinochet's military dictatorship, Skarmeta returned to Chile in order to create political space for freedom. He produced an arts program on television which regularly attracted over 1 million viewers. Skarmeta went on to represent his homeland as the Chilean ambassador to Germany from 2000 to 2003, for which he received the German Cross of Merit. He is probably best known for his novel that became the basis for the 1994 Academy Award-nominated film Il Postino. The title for the novel, Ardiente Paciencia, or Burning Patience, was borrowed from a quote from the French poet Arthur Rimbaud. In choosing the title, he explains, he wanted to say to all men of good faith, to the workers and to the poets, that the entire future was expressed by Rimbaud with this one sentence. Only with burning patience shall we conquer the splendid city that will give light, justice, and dignity to all men. Thus poetry will not have been sung in vain. I just heard this evening that the LA Opera will be producing and premiering Il Postino, the opera, featuring Placido Domingo in the role of Pablo Neruda. Should be a good one. Skarmeta's many books include the novel Matchball and a collection of short stories, Watch Where the Wolf is Going. His most recent book, The Dancer and the Thief, which he'll be signing in the lobby following tonight's program, has just been released in an English translation by W.W. Norton. In conversation this evening with Antonio Skarmeta is Veronica Cortinez. A native of Chile herself, Veronica received a PhD from Harvard and is currently a professor in UCLA's Department of Spanish and Portuguese, where she teaches colonial and contemporary Latin American literature and Chilean film. In 1998, she was awarded the UCLA Distinguished Teaching Award and has twice served as resident director of the University of California's Education Abroad program in Chile. She has written books on Bernal Diaz del Castillo, the Chilean novel, and filmmaker Sergio Castilla, and several articles on Isabel Allende, Jorge Luis Borges, and Carlos Fuentes. She is currently finishing a new book on Chilean film of the 60s. This evening's conversation will be followed by a 10 to 15 minute question and answer period, a golden opportunity to ask that burning question. We'd like to ask you that you limit yourself to one and to make sure that it's a question that you're asking. We have a microphone available for the Q&A, so please wait for it to get to you before asking that question. If it's worth asking, it's worth hearing. Our program this evening will conclude with a book signing in the Taper Lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in silencing our cell phones and in welcoming Antonio Skarmeta and Veronica Cortinez to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Welcome. Thank you very much for being here in the middle of the week. It is a great pleasure and honor to have Antonio Skarmeta with us, although many years ago we invited him to UCLA for the prestigious Regent Fellowship, but that time we couldn't make it. We couldn't have him here. So now we are lucky, and we will have, I hope, a pleasant evening. You want to say a few words?
A few words, yes, hello.
To the audience. We thought we would start having Antonio read a little bit of the novel, introducing us the main male characters. So we are going to start like that, and then we're going to have a conversation, and then at the end, as you know, we're going to have the question and answers. If you could, please.
No, I think, may I stay here and return
yes.
here? Yes, I think it's very comfortable here. In this novel, The Dancer and the Thief, there are three main characters, two men and one woman. The two men are two scoundrels. They have been released from prison. They are not violent criminals. They have been made so. Insignificant crimes, but one of them is a famous safe cracker, a master thief. And they are released and they try to make a living back in society. And that's proved to be very, very hard. And the third character in this novel is a young lady, 17 years old girl. Her name is Victoria, and she's about to end high school, but at this moment she's facing some problems because she's sad. She's sad, and there is a reason. His father was one of the persons who was murdered in the time of the dictatorship in Chile. So this lady has lived with the absence of her father for many, many years. And now she's 17, and you know, teenagers at that age are very sensitive. And the only thing she really wants in life is to dance, and she dreams of being a great dancer. And but to go into a dance academy, she has to end high school, and the things doesn't seem so good for her because she has no force left. And in this novel, it happens that this young lady meets these two scoundrels. That's the beginning of the story. So I may read a little from this. Here, maybe?
Whatever you want.
Okay. No, it's better here.
It's better here.
Yes. The young thief tries to convince the old thief to make a big coup, the heist. And he visits him at his mother's hotel and try to convince him to help him. And I will read from this first meeting when they, both of them, are together. Let me see, where is... Let me see, where is that? Okay. The name of the main character, the young man, is Angel, and the name of the old man, Vergara Gray, the old thief, is Vergara Gray, Nicolas Vergara Gray. And he comes, he opens the door, and he sees the young man, and this is the situation. What can I do for you? The young man brought his hands to his chest in a gesture of prayer and cleared his throat several times before he could get any words out. Vergara Gray, he exclaimed finally. I'm really face to face with the one and only Vergara Gray? I can't believe it. Go light on the melodrama, young man. How may I help you? May I come in? I'd rather you didn't. This room is only very temporary. It's really not up to our standards. Oh, no, sir. It's perfectly fine by me. Bergara Gray walked over to the window. He opened the curtain and felt comforted by the sight of the dim sun filtering through the inevitable June smog. Compared to the miserable day on which he'd been released, this Tuesday felt like a party. He lifted his eyebrows, trying to soften the stern expression he'd exhibited to his visitor so far. What can I do for you, young man? I have here a letter of recommendation. From where? Jail. They released me yesterday. Ah, they threw me out of prison too. Same amnesty, hmm? Destiny has brought us together, the young man quickly added. Is it a letter from the warden? Please, sir, who do you take me for? It's from a prisoner. A prisoner from Lyra, the dwarf. A letter of recommendation from a hoodlum like Lyra? I advise you not to look for work in a bank. Open it and read it, please. The man placed the envelope on the bed, took one dramatic step back, then stood and stared at it with a furrowed brow. The boy picked it up and headed it back to him. Bergara Gray wiped his fingers off on his sweater as if to erase his fingerprints. He scratched open the envelope with his fingernails and took out the thin piece of paper he then held in the air as if it were infested with lice. So, what do you say? The boy asked impatiently, moving the books covering graph paper from one hand to the other. I would like to introduce you to Angel Santiago. Signed, the dwarf. Does it? Does the entire contents of this epistolary masterpiece? Lyra the dwarf's eloquence is as spare as his stature. It would have been too incriminating to say anything else. I'll tell you the rest. I'm happy to hear that, my boy, because this is about as informative as a brick wall. First of all, I'd like to give you these two books. They are used, but in good condition. Thank you. Let's see. Heart and Where I'm Calling From. In Heart, I identified with Garron, the good boy in class. I take it then that your stay in jail was a result of a misunderstanding. Don't make fun of me, sir. In the other one, there's a story about the death of Chekhov. Do you know who Chekhov was? Sounds like the name of a chess player. He's a Russian writer. I've never been interested in politics. Chekhov was from before communism. You might have guessed that I'm not a big reader. Thank you anyway for the books. I will try to take a look at them. Angel waved his arms around wildly. No, no, you don't have to read them, Professor. What matters about these books are their covers. Bergara Gray scratched his head, then rubbed his unshaven cheek. Translation, please. In jail, it is impossible to find better good covers, so we use graph paper. I see. The graph paper is much uglier than the original jacket, so we will remove them at once. Joining action to words, he took the covers of the books and spread them out on the bedspread. Mr. Bergara Gray, Lyra, the dwarf's genius is inversely proportionate to his size. With one sweeping movement, he turned over the book covers. The other sides were covered with intricate and complex hieroglyphics that looked something like a map. They were, in fact, miniature architectural drawings. What's this? This year is the strategy for what I call the big coup, designed step by step by the dwarf. It was going to be his next masterpiece, but he got arrested for some minor job that wasn't worth even a tenth of his talent. He sends this to you as a token of profound admiration and with very cordial regards. I'm sorry, but I'm retired. Please allow me to explain. The man covered his ear. Don't waste your breath. I don't want to hear anything. Okay, just one thing. We are talking about 1.2 billion pesos. What's that in dollars? On the black market, with a dollar of 745 pesos, that would come to about 1.6 million. Okay. Now you listen to a different calculation for different calculation. For every 100,000, that's 1 year away. In $1,610,000, there is 100,000, 16 times, which adds up to 16 years in the slammer. But in order to get your hands on that delightful sum, you can't just lift your arm and cut off a branch laden with pills, as if you were picking a bunch of grapes. You can bet that amount of money will be well protected by guards and gangs. Let's say you have extraordinary good luck and you only kill one person for homicide at... Have you killed anyone yet? No, not yet. Okay, let's see. For the first homicide, you get 10 years. Added to the 16 you already got, that's a total of 26 years in the shade. And if we figure that you are as good as your garron in that book, and they let you off 5 for good behavior, we got 22. How old are you now? 20, sir. You'll get out at 42, probably with other pieces of papers like liras in your pocket. If I come to you, it is because I know you'll never find a shot. That's the beauty of your career. I'm not infallible, young man. After all, they had me inside for 5 years. I even got a few white hairs in my mustache. But they didn't cut you in the act. The judge gave you 10 years because you couldn't squeal. Either you know a lot or you presume a lot. Oh, you are all anybody talk about in jail, Professor Vergara Gray. Of course, Lila the Dwarf would like a commission. A small commission, I hope. Oh, Lila has modest ambition and a really good sense of humor. The man smoothed down his mustache and walked over to the window to hide his smile. He preferred not to get the young ruffian's hope up by showing him that he was amused. Vergara Gray also feared that if he allowed himself any weakness, he could be more vulnerable to temptation. Breakfast could be a good idea. Coffee or tea? Coffee with milk for me. Are you really going to treat me? I'll ask them to bring it up from the bar. In the meantime, we have to get some fresh rolls from the bakery. I'll go. I would greatly appreciate that. What kind do you want? An assortment. I eat a big breakfast and then skip lunch. Understood. Bring, and here comes several names of Chilean kind of breads. So you are not going to recognize any of them except the Chilean in this room. But, okay, that's the way it is. Bring 2 marraquetas, 2 colisas, 3 ayuyas, 3 flautas, 4 tostadas, 3 onion rolls, and 3 slices of kuchen with raisins and candied fruits. At your service, Professor. Oh, yes, and please forgive me, but could you give me some money? I left jail without a penny. The man took a 5,000 peso bill out of his wallet, rolled it up, and stuck it behind Angel's ear. Here you are. The bread is, of course, my treat. This loan is guaranteed by the loot, by the 1.2 billion, by my share of the 1.2 billion. The young man was about to shoot out the door when the older man stretched out his leg to stop him. What made Lyra the dwarf think that you and I could work together? Lyra said, "The technical expertise of Vergara Gray combined with the energy of Angel Santiago." That's pretty sad, Praise. The young man pointed to the drawing on the bedspread. What do you think at first glance? A lot of work has gone into this. Only 3 years. At first, the little guy was worried about leaving any clues. He didn't want to write anything down, afraid they steal his treasure. So we sit in the yard, and he'd explain it to me over and over, drawing it out with a stick in the dirt. Whenever a guard approached, he'd erase it. We'd say we were playing tic-tac-toe, until I had the idea of covering the books in graph paper. A simple but brilliant idea, don't you think? So you are good at remembering things they tell you only once? I don't like to brag, but that's my specialty. I'll just run out to the bakery and be back in a flash. He walked out in the hallway, where the man's urgent voice reached him. Just out of curiosity, Mr. Santiago, what exactly are you going to buy? Bread, of course. Which ones? The young man blinked for 10 seconds, stuck his tongue out between his teeth, then recited while scratching his nose. 2 marraquetas, 2 calisas, 3 ajuyas, 3 flautas, 4 tostadas, 3 onion rolls, and 3 slices of kuchen with raisins and candied fruits. May God be with you, my boy. Don't forget to do your part. My part? Order me a coffee with milk.
I think this novel, as you have seen, can be read sort of a tale on education, about education. I see so many students here from UCLA, so I would like to start by asking Antonio whether it is a commentary on the education he went through when he grew up in Chile and the state of education in Chile today. There is, in the center of the novel, a beautiful scene where the main female character, Victoria, has to take an entrance examination, sort of our SATs, or the Chilean Prueba de Aptitud Académica, and it's a very parodic scene, a very, in a sense, a satire on this type of encyclopedia, crossword puzzle-like education. On the other hand, we see the character, the main male character, as you have seen, Angel, learning through the prison experience and the experience with his master, a different sort of experiences in life, another type of education. And both of them seem to compensate for the lost opportunities in education with poetry. Would you say?
Well, poetry, of course, is a force in this novel. My characters are people who like life, who want to be happy, and they look for opportunities. And they had a very good humor. And they like people, and they like each other. These three characters, they like each other, and they play for the other. They are very, very enthusiastic about life. Now, Victoria, since she has this tragedy, and she's very sad at this moment, she has to prepare this examination. And by preparing this examination, it comes to a moment when the examination is there and the literature teacher asks her about Jorge Manrique. Jorge Manrique is her favorite poet because he wrote the poems to the death of his father. or reading the joy of literature because of a pedantic attitude to what they're teaching. And of course, this is a kind of satire to the situation.
To the Chilean entrance examination and the American also, no? The way of judging one's worth, so to speak. Do you think the Chilean education right now is giving more opportunity to people as opposed to the education you had?
No, they are giving more education. We are living in democracy, and of course, a good education is part of the plans of the democratic government. I think it's difficult to find a way to teach literature to young people. I have been very lucky because some teachers and some professors think that a good way to lead young people to literature is by reading my book, The Postman, where poetry turns to be very seductive. But we have a problem there, of course.
In the original Spanish version of the novel, El Baile de la Victoria, actually at the end there is a dedication to your teachers.
Yes, some of them. One of them, Nicanor Parra, of course.
At the beginning of the dedication, that's right.
Yes. And the teachers, yes.
Your Miss Lozano and...
Oh, yes. Well, the point is that when I was a very young boy, I was living in Argentine, and... At the primary school, some of the teacher discovered that I loved literature, and they stimulated that, and they were very kind with me, and they gave me books, and they gave me one book that had a big influence in my life, Martín Fierro, by José Hernández. It's a kind of national poem in Argentine. And I like it so much because I was a Chilean living in Argentina, and I was very sorry about having had to leave my country and live in another country with another where the people spoke with another accent, and everybody of course named me not by my name but the Chilean, el chileno, and. The people who went to play soccer, the children and other games, and I felt myself a little isolated because of this at the beginning. But since I liked poetry, I began to read poetry, and the professor stimulated me, and every time when there was an act in the school, they asked me to say a poem to the whole school reunited there, gathered right there. And my poems were patriotic or romantic. and Martín Fierro, that was sensational because I love so much the poem that about this guy who has lost his home, and he's in a kind of exile, this gaucho. That I learned it almost by heart, the whole book. And my friends in the neighborhood realized that I knew the Martín Fierro, but they wanted me to say it very quick. So they didn't mind about the content of the film, of the book, but they care about the speed. And they said to me, one of them had a watch. At that time, to have a watch was something. Because a rich boy had to say, "Listen, Carmen, how quick can you tell us the strophe from Martín Fierro?" And I say, "Well, let's see. Well, let's begin." And by example, the second part of Martín Fierro, I went like this. Vamos entrando recién a la parte más sentida, aunque esto ahorita mi vida más de una cadena que a la doloría le gusta cantar su pena. Se comenzó en aquel entonces a recoger allá, a reunir la milicada, teniendo un cantón para una expedición a sorprender a la India. Nos anunciaron que iríamos sin carreta ni bagaje a golpear a los salvajes en sus mismas tolerías y que de vuelta pagaría el licenciando a la gauchacha. Y en esta expedición tuvieron la esperanza que iba a venir sin tardanza, según el jefe contó, un ministro, qué sé yo, que le llamaban Don Ganza. Que iba a reunir todo el ejército de Tubito, los batallones y que traía unos cañones con barra y un cotín. Pucha, las conversaciones para allá las tenía fin. And I went over and over and over, and the boy say, okay, you did it this time, second part, in 50 minutes. Try tomorrow to do it in 40. That was my record. About in 40 minutes, I said the whole Martín Fierro. And I kept it in mind. Well, since I was a child, I really loved poetry.
Crossing the Andes, you, of course, the book is full of Gabriela Mistral references, Neruda, Jorge Manrique, of course, but also Parra, whom you dedicate the book.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because of the introduction of a very ironic poetry. This anti-poetry is full of spontaneity, intelligence. There are not many rhetorical images, not big metaphors. A kind of poetry that is very, very, very modern and very deep and nervous commentaries on contemporary life. That's the reason why I like it so much. And I like very much the epitaph he proposed for himself.
Which is?
I'll be back in a minute.
There is also a version a character likes of a poem by Gabriela Mistral, the Chilean poet, of a poem called Piececitos de Niño, which is quoted in the novel. And you make a character prefer Parra's verse, which is Marx mío.
What says the poem by Gabriela Mistral? Piececitos de Niño, azuloso de frío, como hay quien nos ve y nos cubre, Dios mío. A Parra says, piececito de niño, azuloso de frío, como os ven y nos cubren, Marx mío.
So also there we go into politics. Why is so essential to you politics, your relationship with politics? I am not forcing you to talk necessarily about Pinochet. It's sometimes a bit repetitive for Chilean writers to have to talk about Pinochet. But your relationship with politics from the 60s, during the Allende government, on exile, and the relationship with literature?
The point is, when you live in a Latin American country, you're exposed to politics. Politics is not something that you do one day, a super Tuesday, when you go and vote. Politics belong to your everyday life. You're discussing about politics all the time because these countries are on the move all the time, so you have to take decisions. It's not that me or my characters want to have something to do with politics. They face politics. They are confronted with politics, with violence. They have a vocation to be happy, like I had. And suddenly, politics is there, knocking on the door and destroying your door and going into your house and in a very violent way sometimes. And sometimes politics is a way to realize, to make real dreams. So in Chile we have had the dreams and the nightmare in a very short period of time. That's the reason why I cannot separate politics from my life. Even I'm the kind of writer who takes part at the tasks of the society. So I love writing more than anything in the world. But I had taken some political responsibilities. At the time of the Unidad Popular with President Allende, he was a man who was didn't want to be a dictator. He was a man who wanted to create in Chile a deeper democracy, the way we know democracy here and in the whole world. And the forces that supported him, they were not after a social realism the way they knew it in the Soviet Union. No, it was a Democrat. That's the reason why it was so sad that they destroyed this project. And then came exile and dictatorship and all the third things you know. And how can you avoid? How can you avoid noticing this and writing about this when it's affecting your life? A curious thing is that after the coup, I decided to leave the country and I went to West Berlin. And in West Berlin, I lived many years, 13 years, until the Chileans recovered democracy. And I came back in 1988. And I decided to make a TV program on books and author, because I thought that everything after the dictatorship, the heritage of the dictatorship was so idiot, so stupid. All the programs on TV were so banal and ridiculous. And so I tried a different kind of program based on literature and authors. And it worked. I did it with humor, with dramatizations, with plays, with music. And it worked. We had a huge rating for a cultural program for the first time in Chile.
El show de los libros was called.
El show
called,
de los no? libros. So that was my way to intervene again in politics, opening the mind of the audience, proposing them new images, different to the conventional images they were used to see. But then, once again, I had to take a decision, because year 2000, the Democratic President Lagos offered me to be ambassador, Chilean ambassador in Germany. And I had to take a decision. Oh boy,
tempting.
Shall I accept it or not? Because from a writer, their readers don't expect necessarily that that the writer is related to a government, to a specific government. But I said, oh, I have to work against the dictatorship. Pinochet's dictatorship so long, and now we have a new democracy, and they want me to represent this democracy in the country where I was an exile. That will give credibility to my work. And as a matter of fact, when I came to West Berlin, the new capital of Germany, since I was very active in Europe in the time of exile in Germany, I used to know all the people who were now in very important positions. So the guys who were discussing about, let's take the Greens, Los Verdes, the guys who were discussing at that time when I was young with them, if they would go into formal politics or to remain apart from the system, at the margins of politics. Do we create... That was the question the Greens made themselves. Do we create a party or not? And there was a discussion between the realos and the fundis, the fundamentalists and the realists. And as you know, they created a party, a very successful one. So when I came to Germany, one of them with whom I was on the streets demonstrating, as well, he was the foreign minister. So, oh my goodness, that was my work as ambassador was really a piece of cake, because I had to open all the scene, because the time of exile, I used that time to work politically. I opened my heart and my mind to the culture. I didn't know a word of German. I learned German, so I worked with him. And so when I went back as an ambassador, of course, I had almost every 2 days a story about me in the papers. And I could bring the message of the new Chilean democracy.
And you brought over many people.
Yes, I did it 3 years long, but then I said, okay, I have enough. Done it, so it's okay. And then I presented I renounced, because was too much. I said, if I keep working like this, I'm not going to write anymore. That's
a good decision. No, working in cinema started in Germany, intensified greatly in Germany, no?
It has started in Germany. I wrote many film scripts for German directors. One of them, Peter Lilienthal, I wrote 3 or 4 scripts for him. And I wrote some other script. But the first film I made as a director was the first version of Il Postino, or The Postman.
Ardiente Paciencia.
Yeah, many people don't know this film. It's a low-budget film.
It's a beautiful film, actually.
Made 1983. Well, now, after the world success of Il Postino, there are some people who are curious about this film. And here and there I show it, and they compare Il Postino to Ardiente Paciencia.
How would you compare it? Compare both.
Let's see. So, my film, Ardiente Paciencia, that means burning patience, is the film of a writer who makes a movie. And the film by Michael Radford, Il Postino, is a film of a film director who knows what he's doing.
Do you like Il Postino better? You can't compare them.
No, I have to say that Il Postino is a beautiful, it was a world success. It has helped my literature. Before the Il Postino was made, my books were... The book was already translated into 15 languages. After the big success of the film, there was re-edition of the book. And by now, Il Postino, the postman, is translated into 35 languages. So, this is, what can I say against Il Postino? I think it's a lovely film.
You were not directly involved with the new Chilean film movement at the end of the 60s, were you? I remember reading an insightful article of yours on Raúl Ruiz, the Chilean filmmaker,
yes.
On the movie Three Sad Tigers in the late 60s.
Sure, I wrote about films, about books. I used to make commentaries on culture in Chile. But... I like directing film and writing script. The only problem with directing films is that you have to get very early in the morning. And I'm not that kind of guy. I'm rather lazy.
But you belong to the group of filmmakers in Chile, no? Who gathered around El Bosco.
I wouldn't say that I'm a filmmaker. I'm known in Chile
as a writer.
But since I have made a couple of... Well,
movies.
Ardiente Paciencia, and I was related to some other films. Okay, I have a touch of filmmaker, but only that.
In Chile, actually, you are seen as a very versatile personality. I mean, somebody who had this program in the television, very successful, astonishingly successful, El Show de los Libros, movies and literature, sports even. I mean, you know, didn't you go to horse
The horse
races.
Racing. Oh, my goodness.
He was a fan of the horse racing.
You know too much. Now, sometimes I have to go to go to the horse races. You know, but don't tell anybody.
And you include in your literature, I mean, there is a mix of all sort of type of culture, the oral, the written, music, literature, You are sort of doing a synthesis of Chilean culture in your books.
Well, I would accept that you are right, but if I take a look back at my literature and I see what is my literary project, what is my literature? I see that there is a wish to put together the high culture as I have read it in my career, and my studies at the university, my love, my favorite poet and dramatist, writer of all the times is William Shakespeare. That's the books, The Complete Works by Shakespeare is the book I had
in your night table.
Night table, and Cervantes, and of course poets like San Juan de la Cruz, or the poems by Walt Whitman, Lope de Vega. Spanish theater classical Spanish theater. These are my favorite. So I have a contact, and this literature had made a big impression on me. But at the same time, I like pop culture, subculture, and all the manifestations of subculture. And one of the things I think I have done is to bring together both of them, so to bring the energy of everyday life into the classical literature and to show it under new, different lights. And on the other hand, I try to bring this high culture to put it into the life of everyday people. And that's the reason why I make a television program. But also the way I write. Let's take the Dancer and the Thief. these two scoundrels, they have been in prison, and they have read books.
That's right.
A couple of them. Right. A couple of them. But once, about the story by Chekhov, it's a story by Raymond Carver.
That's right. That
and at the very end, when they are doing the coup, the big heist, they discuss the story by Carver, and they discuss minimalism. So in the way, what they understand about that, they do. And even once, Vergara Gray, the old safe cracker, quotes Shakespeare.
Yes.
And then the young man say, "Hey, master, you quoting Shakespeare? Oh, my God." And he says, "But it's not so strange. I have been several times in jail, almost all the time with honorable people, and sometimes with Englishmen."
Antonio, would you like to read a piece, a second piece, where we see the introduction of Victoria, the female character?
Not the introduction, but this is a very short one. Don't worry. It's just a piece. Victoria, you know, it's a story of the friendship between Victoria and these two men. And you know that Victoria's father is dead, has been killed. The mother is under depression, so she has no force to do anything. And she wants to live, and she wants to love, and she wants to dance. And there's an opportunity for doing that, to escape from home. And she has to tell her mother that she's leaving. And this is the situation. I read it because it keeps... it shows another aspect of the... of the novel. Now, this time it's really only two pages, no, don't worry. When Victoria told her mother that she was going to disappear for a while, the woman increased the speed of her needle across the sweater she was decorating with cross stitching and understood this to mean that the girl could go live with a young man with disheveled hair and in some run-down rooming house. She may have wanted to say something. She could have said, "That's wonderful. You have your guy and your dance. You dance what you are, as the critic said. Be yourself. Perfect. I won't take it as abandonment." But the mother said nothing to her daughter. Victoria navigated through the silence, knowing that her back was packed and ready upstairs, that within a few hours she would place it on her shoulder and wrap herself in her father's overcoat. She had the honesty to tell her mother that hers would be a long absence, so long that years might pass before they could see each other again. Her mother stopped her needlework and looked at her knees as if they belonged to a distant landscape. She had sunk into a deathly silence. Victoria's leaving could mean only one thing: secrecy, the resistance, and therefore death. With any luck, a car from the morgue would one day come get her to identify her daughter's disfigured corpse. She told her as much. She said, "They are going to kill you, my love. You got stuck in a time warp, Mama. We are now living in a democracy. Nobody can kill me because nobody is shooting at anybody. There's no resistance. There's no terrorism. No armed struggle. There's not even a political struggle. It's not like in Papa's day. You are going into hiding and they are going to kill you. Your picture will appear in the newspapers, and many people will come with me to mourn you. After that, I'll be alone." She picked up her knitting, and with one edge that ended in an ochre-colored ball of yarn, she wiped the side of her nostrils. "You should be happy, Mama. I'm going to be alive and happy somewhere else. Not dead, but dancing." where, let's say, Brazil. Don't leave before I finish this sweater. I have to leave tomorrow, and you still got a lot to do. You'll come back and get it when it's finished. Of course. I liked eating vegetable soup with you. I'm going to miss you. Because of the soup, I also like eating chicken soup with you. You never told me, Mama. Tomorrow, I'll make an apple strudel and serve it with the tea. That will be perfect, Mama. I figured the sweater will be ready in... What month are we in? July. We've still got 2 months of winter. To tell you the truth, I really don't think I'll be coming back that soon. Maybe next year. I'll be dead before then. Why do you talk about death so much, Mama? It's like you're sticking an ice cube right on my bones. I'll come back on a very cold day with lots of rain, and I'll put on the sweater, and I'll say, thank you, Mama, it turned out beautiful.
Would you say art is the rebellion of the human being against death? Death that is so overpresent in this novel.
Sounds a little romantic, I should say.
No, but in your experience.
I'm not that romantic.
In your real experience, was art somehow a protection?
I would like to say yes, but I haven't thought of that. As the art for me is just the necessity of expression, a need of the soul, an enthusiasm for life, a feeling of how people are. I don't think that, for me, that it has such a purpose. I have read many poets who say, okay, art is a way to survive to death, but it's not my case. I think that these are two big words for me.
Two big words, yeah. But in the novel, somehow they are protected by art. I mean, the dream of Victoria and the beautiful scene, I don't know how many of you have already read it, some students I know have already, the scene where she actually is allowed to dance in the middle of the very prestigious...
Hey, don't reveal that much.
I'm not revealing.
Don't reveal that much.
But don't you think in the novel, somehow, art is a protection against death for her?
I mean, that's my feeling. When I wrote The Postman, I knew that I was expressing something that is true, that people, even very humble, everyday people, little people, they have a need for expression, and that they cherish, they appreciate very much when somebody, let's say a poet like Neruda or some other poet, write things that they feel and they cannot express. I said that in a very comedian way in The Postman once. There is a moment, the postman comes to Neruda and Neruda explains to him what a metaphor is. And he's fascinated, the postman, and says, oh God, oh dear God, oh, how much I would like to be a poet. And then the Neruda asks him, and if you were a poet, what do you want to say? Well, I could say all the things I want to say. And what do you want to say? Well, that's a problem. Since I'm not a poet, I cannot say it. That's my experience with life. My experience of life, if I can make a little cheap philosophy among this very cultivated audience, is that human beings are what they are, but more than what they are what they want to be, what they dream. They are always heading towards something. They want all the time things to be better. And as a poet, as a writer, you have to see that light that is leading them. So realism for me is not a naturalistic view of people and how they act, but realism is for me poetic realism, to understand who they are, why they are the way they are, and where are they heading to, and this tension between what they are and what they want. That's the human being for me. And then when they ask me to describe my literature, that's the reason why I say, okay, what I write is poetic realism. That is. And these characters, they have one foot in reality and one foot in poetry. I cannot deny it. That's the way
it's the first
I am. And some people, of course, like it, some others not. Some understand it, some critics love it, some others say, oh my goodness, but that's my life.
It's a sort of urban magic realism that is, I think, very new, no? Well, on that note, I would like to open it up for a question and answers. If you have any questions, hopefully not at, on the end of the novel. Yes?
I liked your the humor idea of approaching politics, and I noticed that in our country, or I don't know how much you are part of our country, but talking about politics has become almost something that's considered antisocial, and this idea has grown so much that it's not polite to talk about politics. Why do you think politics is so much part of your culture and we in our country are losing the ability to talk about politics here in a polite way or a humorous way?
My experience in Chile and in some other Latin American countries that I know very well Argentina because I lived there, I know Brazil quite good. I just say that that politics is about getting together. That getting together is a natural way to do politics. And sometimes in some societies, maybe this one, or maybe some European societies, people tend to live alone. It's a family, it's a small group. Let's talk about the big success of the Latin American novel in the 60s, The Boom. Europeans were fascinated by Latin American literature because what they discovered, I have analyzed this subject, why Latin American literature was so attractive. Manfred, maybe you can discuss this point. Why was Latin America so successful? García Márquez and Vargas Llosa and some poets like Ernesto Cardenal, you see. Why? Because at that time, the European reader felt that every little story that was told, a love story, a romantic thing, a family story, was connected to something bigger that contained that. It was not only a private thing. It was something that was inserted in history, in future, in past. So this togetherness. And this togetherness, you find the political work in everyday life, and people don't repress themselves. Think of how many people who were active in politics were killed because of that, because how much they risked, how much they dared to do. Okay, in Chile we found a solution, and we get rid of the dictatorship, and we did it in a very pacific way to democracy. Democracy we have today, but people don't mention how many people died to get this democracy that with so many problems, with so many formality, with so many people who committed crimes against human rights and who are still free on the streets. I think that's the reason. I don't know exactly the situation in United States, but it looks like people get excited about politics when they are facing big problems. Let's say a war that's extremely inconvenient, or some elections where they can change things. But it doesn't belong to but maybe that is a very superficial observation. That.
Any other question? Mark, would you like to Manfred, would you like to respond? Can you hear? No, it cannot. Can you bring them? No. 1 second. Thank you.
So, we have Angel and Nicolas as the scoundrels at the core of the novel.
The two scoundrels.
The two scoundrels. But there's another one released... which is Rigoberto Marin.
Oh, God, yes.
And what shocked me is that...
Don't say the ending.
I won't talk about the ending, of course, I won't. I'm an academic, but not a spoiler, so... but what shocked me was the name he gave himself, Alberto Parachacón.
Yes.
Alluding, well, you could explain, and this is and he accepts it himself as something genius, much higher than him, but that gives him a strange touch of humanity in an angel of hell. So, what do you think about this? Your other scoundrel.
The other scoundrel. Well, the moment Angel Santiago is released, he's released and he has a project, and his project is to take revenge of the warden because the warden had done to him something very bad. And the warden suspects, this begins like a criminal novel, yes. And it's not. The warden suspects, and he feels that this young man wants to kill him. And so he hires a professional killer who is in jail to kill Angel. And so the shadow of this danger hangs over Angel through all the novel. Fate, destiny. Khalid Shakespeare knows a lot about this. Manfred, since we are here, I make a very short resume of the novel, and then I decided this time to leave away the other guy, but the other guy is quite a character too. And you know that it's going to be a film is going to be made out of this novel. The same producer who made Il Postino, and afterwards he made Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni. He acquired the rights. And the director is going to be a Spaniard, Fernando Trueba, who got here in this city an Academy Award for Belle Époque some years ago. And I have written the script together with him because I thought this is a good idea. It is better to write the script with the director so that he doesn't change too much the story. And we did that, and we became friends. So the film is going to be shot sometime this year. It's going to be a Hispanic-American film, spoken in Spanish.
Where will it be shot?
The idea is to shoot in Chile, in the original places, but there is an Argentinian producer who is very interested to shoot some parts of the film there. And one of the character, one of the actors is going to be an Argentinian actor, so he feels like shooting some scenes in Argentina too. So.
That the other side of the hand, that's right. Sí, yes. One second.
Thank you. You read a little bit about a dwarf there. Would you talk a little bit about that character briefly in your novel? What is his role and what is he doing there?
excuse me. About which character?
A dwarf.
El enano.
Ah, the dwarf. The dwarf. El enano, Lira. Well, he's a guy who has a long sentence, and he has this plan. He knows how to get to a safe where this lot of money is, and he has to make these drawings. And he's a man. He has a wife, and. Since Santiago, Angel, just Santiago, is a very nice guy, very sympathetic, he wants to help him, and he proposes that he makes. And the dwarf conceives this plan because there is a space in the novel that, because of his stature, there is something he can do. Well, I don't want to go into details, but the dwarf, you know, all people who are very small are all the time making jokes about how small they are. There was a famous Latin American writer from Guatemala, Tito Monterroso, who was really very little, and he made a lot of jokes about himself. One of the things he said were small sentences like, "Era tan pequeño que no le cabía ninguna duda." And this, I'm sorry about it, but it's impossible to translate into English. So maybe yes, who dares to do it? Yes.
He couldn't hold a doubt. There was no room for a doubt. That's it.
And no room for he left no room for doubt.
<That's> right.
And the other one that is very good, that it comes in the novel, is the dwarves. So dwarves have a... No, I can't say it in English because if I made a mistake, it's terrible. But they said it in Spanish, but I have it here, the translation. Los enanos, that's from Monterroso, los enanos tienen una especie de sexto sentido que les permite reconocerse a primera vista. Okay, I forget it about it. the last one in Spanish. Another one from Monterroso. Escribió una obra de teatro. Le dijeron que se creía Shakespeare. Escribió una novela. Le dijeron que se creía Cervantes. Escribió un cuento. Le dijeron que se creía Gogol. Escribió un poema. Le dijeron que se creía Neruda. Escribió un epitafio. Le dijeron que se creía difunto. Sorry, that's the last one. Okay. All the rest in English.
Yes. Susana.
I wonder if you could comment.
Here.
It's a privilege to hear you this evening. You probably know about the Los Angeles Philharmonic commissioning an opera based on your text and on Il Postino. We have the composer here, in fact, Daniel Catán, with us. I wonder if you could comment on that, how your text is going into other arts?
Well, I really wonder, because Daniel Catan was so kind to like the novel I have written, to like the film, and he proposed me to give him the rights to adapt this to an opera. And he said, I'm going to take some time to write it. And I was with him yesterday, and he gave me the very, very good news that the opera is finished. So he wrote it. He wrote it. And the very good news is that the role of Neruda is going to be sung by Plácido Domingo. The role of the postman will be sung by Rolando Villazón, and the role of Neruda's wife, Matilde, by Cristina Gallardo Doma. So it looks like a good cast. But I don't know anything. I don't know, because I haven't heard nothing but the word. I know that he's a brilliant composer or companist?
Composer.
A brilliant composer, but I haven't heard nothing of this of this opera. So maybe you live in the city. I live tomorrow, but you can take a look or ask.
Susana is very involved with the opera.
Ah, well.
That's why.
Could you like to comment something on that?
Daniel?
No? Okay.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could say something about the experience of either working with translators or seeing your works in translation.
Interesting. I can say something about that because I have been a translator too. When I was a young man, a student at the university, I translated from English into Spanish works by Jack Kerouac. A novel I liked very much, Visions of Gerard. I translated novels by Scott Fitzgerald. I translated Typee by Herman Melville. And some plays, one play by Edward Albee. So I appreciate very much the translator's work. I know that in Germany, I worked very close, because I lived a long time there, very closely with the translator, and he was the translator of almost all my works. And in this case, by the Dancer and the Thief, I was in Santiago, and the translator was here in the States. But when he finished the translation, we went over the phone and over mails, page by page, and trying to make the novel fluent in English. And then the publisher, the editor, also had a word to say. And so we were cutting the small things that were really not relevant, and we were changing some words, and I realized the point is that sometimes we Latin Americans tend to write with too many metaphors, with too much passion. And this passion sometimes is related to a kind of irony. So and this irony together with passion works in our language. But sometimes it doesn't sound very good in English. It's not a thing of finding the right words. It's a thing of finding the right mood. Yeah. And we were hard with not hard, but a lot with the translator, because it was a very, very pleasant work. And the critics I have read up to now, they praised the translation.
One last question. I saw a... That's enough? Okay. So, thank you very much for coming here and for participating. Thank you, Antonio.
Well, thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Allowed theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.